It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wall Street Journal reported early this morning that the United States intercepted transmissions from Iran to militants in Iraq, apparently saying, hey, attack the American embassy, other American interests in Baghdad in the event of a strike on Syria.
We've got a guest with us now, Aaron David Miller. He's with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And for the prior two decades, he served at the Department of State working on Middle East issues. And David, welcome. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you give us the latest on what's happened with these latest reports?
Well, I think the reports reflect a certain reality, that if, in fact, the administration acts either with authorization to use force validated by Congress or without, there's likely to be a reaction, a violent reaction, against the strike. And I think it will come not in direct retaliation by the Iranians or the Syrians or Hezbollah, but in an indirect sort of asymmetrical way against soft targets. And the softest targets are American interests in the Middle East, embassies, diplomatic installations, Ala Benghazi, individuals, American citizens. So, you know, it shows that for every action, there's likely to be a reaction. I suppose if you wanted to shape the debate, current debate in Congress, that you would make sure that such an intercept appeared, because it really is, it will sow a lot of doubt and continued uncertainty in the reaction of those representatives and senators who think this is a bad idea.
So you're implying that the leak was intentional?
No, I think they may have made a virtue out of necessity. I mean, I suspect that the Iranians have alerted most of their assets throughout the region. All I'm saying is it doesn't hurt the Iranian case. In fact, that there's a signal that there will be a response. I don't think it would affect the administration's calculations or the calculation of legislators who will decide this for many other reasons other than fear of an Iranian response against an embassy. It is a reality, though, and as you know, we've lost diplomats and embassies over the course of the last 30 or 40 years in large measure as a consequence of Islamic extremists and fundamentalists, Sunni and Shia, eager to settle scores with the United States.
Now, we have been waiting for action from President Obama. The U.S. has known there would be some sort of action, as indicated by the president, but now we're waiting for a congressional vote. What do you think the delay has meant in terms of retaliation plans like this?
I don't think it affects it at all. I think there's very little sense of urgency or emergency in what the administration wants to do. And, they are torn between making a point and making a difference. And I think they want to do both. And I don't think the delay, frankly, will affect the administration's plans or the target sets one way or another. Not going ahead, and I'm not arguing that we should or shouldn't, but not going ahead will, in fact, send a powerful signal in the end that the administration is simply not prepared to make good on its red lines. And let's be clear, this is not a presidential red line. Once the president of the United States draws such a line, it becomes an American red line. And here, I think the president's personal credibility and the national interest are now intertwined in a way that may not be terribly helpful.
Well, do you think that what we've heard will affect the message the president will deliver to the American people?
Well, I think the president has to make a case. And if you're sitting in Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, you're not deeply invested in these issues, you don't study foreign policy, you're absorbed with your own personal situation, your job, your family, uncertainties over health care, maybe you're unemployed in the wake of the Great Recession. The reality is that the president is hard-pressed to make a case that it is in the vital national interest of the United States to apply military force. I mean, there may well be reasons to do it, but to impress the vast majority of the American public in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan that this is a good idea, that it's effective, and that it's going to really make a difference, that's a very tough sell. And I think if you look at the constituency response throughout the country and the ABC Washington Post polls, whatever polls Pew have done, you see where the public debate on this issue is trending. It's not trending towards support. Now, that doesn't mean that the people's elected representatives, even though the public says no, or we have doubts, that Congress won't go ahead. The Senate, for example, may decide to vote out positively the authorization to use force, and the House may decide not to. So there are any number of outcomes here. And frankly, the history of the presidency demonstrates pretty compellingly that presidential addresses have very little impact on shaping or moving the public, particularly on an issue like this, in which the trend lines appear to be running against military action.
Now, getting back to the threat of retaliation among Syrian allies, now we've got the embassies on the radar. What about seeing retaliation on American soil, you know, here in the country of America and not at embassies? And what about also the possibility that has been raised about Israel being in danger?
Well, here's the reality. You know, we are safer since 9/11, but we are not safe. And whether or not an American strike adds to the threat assessment, there are in real time all kinds of plans and hopes on the part of a disturbingly large number of Muslims in this region who are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, who would like to inflict a catastrophic attack on the United States. I mean, attacking Syria arguably could add to that. But I'm not sure that would be a compelling reason in the debate not to do it. We need to be vigilant, nonetheless, and regardless. As far as the Israelis are concerned, I think the Israelis, Israel has several calculations. And if the Syrians don't violate any of Israel's red lines, and unlike our red lines, the Israelis are prepared to enforce theirs for many reasons, in large part because they are in the neighborhood and likely to be subject, to immediate harm if they don't maintain their own credibility. But I suspect that the Syrian regime, particularly if the attack that the president would like to launch is far more devastating than we have been led to believe, and it may well be, that the last thing the Syrians need right now is to draw the Israelis into this fight.
Now, I've read that you've used that same phrase before, that movement from the United States to intervene could be more devastating than we've been led to believe. What makes you think that it will be, and why hasn't it been billed that way, if that's the case?
Well, because you're looking at a set of targets. You know, the avowed position of the administration is to deter the Syrians from using chemical weapons and to degrade the Syrian capacity to use them. All right, so what does that really mean, degrade the capacity? Well, if you're not going to actually attack the stocks themselves, and you can't, because there are all kinds of risks of dispersal of these agents, and the fact is the Syrians have tons of this stuff, which are located all over the country. If you're not going to attack the stocks, then you only have two remaining sets of targets. You attack the delivery systems, and you attack the force protection systems. And what that means, essentially, is going after aircraft, runways, command and control, military units that have actually been involved in deploying these units. The 4th Brigade that got responsibility for security in the Damascus area was implicated in this most recent attack. You then go after those assets. And those assets not only help deliver chemical weapons, they are part and parcel of Assad's military power. So you see the target sets expanding. So my only point is that I think, and the administration is unclear in terms of their own rhetoric about whether or not this is designed to degrade Assad's capabilities. Is it designed to tip the battlefield balance, as Senator John McCain wants? Or is it simply designed to punish and try to deter. I think the objectives are very murky, and if, in fact, the Syrians retaliate, which is certainly a possibility, or use chemical weapons again, the administration will strike again. And that's one of the reasons that Congress is debating a resolution that would give the administration up to 60 days to operate militarily. I suspect this will consist of 2 or 3 days, maybe more, of intensive missile and perhaps fixed-wing airstrikes as well.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure.
That was Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.
Coming up next, more damaging news for the National Security Agency from the latest Edward Snowden leaked documents. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
More news today in the saga of leaked documents from the National Security Agency. The new documents show the NSA has been working secretly with other intelligence agencies to obtain private encryption keys.
Bruce Schneier is with us. He's a security technologist and author of a dozen books on the topic of security. His newsletter is Cryptogram, and his blog is called Schneier on Security. Bruce, welcome to the show.
No, thanks for having me.
Bruce, according to some sources, this latest leak about the NSA is perhaps the most damaging. Can you explain why some people may think that?
So what this shows is not just that the NSA is eavesdropping on the entire internet, which we learned from previous leaks, but it is systematically subverting the security protections that we, who have built the internet, put in place. They have broken most of the encryption algorithms used to protect data. Not through mathematical means, but primarily through subverting the companies that make the products. So you might buy a Microsoft product, I'm using this as a random example, believing it's secure, but in fact, Microsoft might have a secret agreement with the NSA to break the cryptography in a way the NSA knows.
So you're saying that companies are complicit in what's been going on with the busting of encryption?
According to the documents, there are a variety of different methods. There is, please do this for the good of the country, and the companies agree. There is coercion, do this or we'll make your life miserable. And then there's outright legal threats, all the way to national security letters, which do this because we demand it and you're not allowed to tell anybody. All these things are going on. We read about that the NSA has moles, secret government programmers in corporations secretly adding these backdoors. And right now, we don't know who to trust. These flaws are in there for everybody. They make the internet less secure for everybody. Other people can use them, right? You know, we have no way of noting if Edward Snowden was the first leaker. Likely not. And this really does just break the trust in all the internet. It's really devastating.
Now, as a consumer, you know, I probably do average stuff online. I buy plane tickets. I buy tickets to movies. I buy some products over the internet. What does it mean for me?
Well, it means all the security you have in place, protecting your credit card numbers, protecting your private information, protecting your data in cloud services, protecting your communications, actually is much less secure than you thought. And the U.S. government has subverted all that security for their use, and we don't know for who else. And a really interesting example of this happened in Greece several years ago. The country put in wiretapping abilities into its phone system because the police wanted to wiretap. Turns out that the criminals used it too, and there was a huge scandal of government officials being wiretapped by criminals in Greece. So once you build the infrastructure of surveillance, you can no longer control who uses it. And that's just very dangerous, very destabilizing. This plays into the hands of Russia and China, other countries that are subverting the internet. Now they can say, well, look what the Americans do. And that is, I think, an international disaster. Human rights organizations are now at risk, and we're all at risk.
So the idea being that the government says, yes, we've broken the encryption, we've got encryption keys, but it's for your own good, we're protecting you, but you're saying, no, it can fall into the wrong hands, and then we're all in trouble.
Now, yeah, this makes us all much less safe. The notion that they are protecting us from one small risk by giving us much larger risks, I think it's very short-sighted. This is dangerous, this is destabilizing, and it's not going to end well. There's going to be huge amounts of business lost to American companies, as especially foreign companies, foreign individuals say, we can't put our stuff in U.S. companies. They're untrustworthy. We're going to see huge relationship strains with foreign governments. We're already seeing that. And I'm not sure what's going to happen.
What do you think Americans make of this? Now, it's been in the news, but it hasn't been, you know, we haven't seen rioting in the streets about it. We haven't seen people in mass numbers anyway rushing to the defense of Edward Snowden. Do people care about this right now?
You know, it's hard to tell. Certainly in the technological community, we care a lot. Those of us who have built the Internet, who designed the protocols, who keep it running, there's huge outrage. But that's, you know, that's the techies. That's a very narrow slice. You know, my mother called me. She said she was proud of the articles I wrote but didn't understand them. Mm-hmm. So there's the other side of it. This is a complicated story. And unfortunately, that plays into the NSA's hands. The more people are confused, the more they'll let them do it. So we're working on ways to explain this better. But, you know, there is more outrage about NSA overreach. The polls don't look good. People are saying for the first time that government surveillance is worse than the possibility of terror. And I think that's very healthy. You know, that some American values are more important than sitting there being scared of a few terrorists. And so hopefully things are changing.
Bruce, you're a security technologist. You're obviously a techie. You've got your Cryptogram newsletter. So you're someone who's been invested in the infrastructure of the Internet and online communities, who cares about it, who knows about it. Wasn't this inevitable? I mean, from your point of view, if there's encryption, someone's going to try to hack it, and it might as well be the government, I suppose, because at least maybe they have better security than someone else might.
Well, it turns out they don't, since someone managed to walk out of the government with hundreds of thousands of top-secret documents. The issue is not that someone's going to try to hack it. The question is the systematic subversion of the entire system. Of course people are going to hack security. They do it all the time. Criminals do it. Governments do it. Researchers do it. It's a huge arms race. It's cat and mouse. It's kind of what keeps us in business. This is fundamentally different. Right? This is the government systematically subverting the entire system because of its privileged position, both monetarily and legally, in secret. They have made the Internet less safe for everybody.
What would you like people to do if there were to be an uprising, if people were to get upset about this and want to make a change, want to affect what happens next? What do you want people to do?
I think we need to rein the NSA in. The NSA has been above the law. They do things without any oversight. They do things without any transparency. And they've been getting away with breaking the law. And this just needs to change. Of course we need intelligence. Of course we need eavesdropping. Of course we want to spy on our enemies. We all do that. But there's a difference between that and this runaway organization that has fundamentally gone rogue.
What about the argument that we live in an age when we have to make difficult decisions and personal privacy might be something that we have to sacrifice at least a portion of to trade for safety?
And, well, one, it's a silly argument because privacy is part of safety. The other is that no one says that there shouldn't be any way for the government to eavesdrop. We already give the government enormous powers to peer into our personal lives. We do it for good reason. They have to solve crimes. But look at the mechanism. We force the government to go into a court and say, this is what we want to do and this is why. They get a warrant. This due process protects us from government overreach. Right? That is transparency and oversight. Those are the mechanisms that are lacking. Put those mechanisms in place, and yes, you could have government peer into our personal lives. It's perfectly reasonable, and we do it all the time.
Do you think Congress is with you on this? Do you think that we will see legislation reining it in a bit?
You know, it's possible. Actually, it's probably probable. What's interesting is this doesn't fall along normal party lines. This isn't Republican versus Democrat. We have Democrats who are saying this is fine. Feinstein is one of them. We have James Stensenbrenner, Republican congressman who wrote the Patriot Act, saying this is an abomination and an abuse of the law he wrote. As the fact that this is not falling on party lines gives me hope of actual policy debate instead of party rhetoric. So maybe.
So we've only got about 10 seconds, but what did you say to your mom when she didn't understand? Did you explain it to her?
I said I'd have to work on it.
Okay. All right. Well, Bruce, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Bruce Schneier, internationally renowned security technologist and author of a dozen books on the topic of security. His newsletter is Cryptogram, and his blog is Schneier on Security. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up next, an update in an ongoing series on cold cases. Cold cases, unsolved crimes in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This summer, Post-Crescent Media examined cold cases in Wisconsin for a series that focused on things like how unsolved crimes affect families and how information on cold cases is organized.
They're wrapping up the series this weekend, looking at some of the hurdles, costs, and opportunities in solving these cold cases. Nick Penzenstadler joins us now. He's a reporter for Post-Crescent Media. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of what you're looking at in this wrap-up is the barriers, what makes it so hard to solve cold cases, and one of them is the money. How much does it cost a local police department to chip away at a cold case?
Right, yeah, that's exactly what we were looking at, and a good example of this is what's done in Milwaukee, since Milwaukee does have the most and the largest majority of open investigations into murders and unsolved murders, and the devil's in the details. When they have extra money, they solve more cases. So they have a two-person full-time staff, and they usually solve about 2 to 3 cases every year. But when they do get big national funding, that number can jump up to 10 or more.
So that's it almost sounds random. They don't know if the money's going to be there. They don't know how much time and effort they're going to be able to put into this.
Well, a lot of it comes down to the NIJ, that's the National Institute of Justice grant funding, which is on a yearly basis, and it's a big application process, competitive around the nation, and the Department of Justice represents Wisconsin to get that funding, along with the Milwaukee Police Department. So it really comes down to if they're awarded that funding and whether they can put it to good use.
And what procedures are so costly in pursuing these cases?
The biggest tool with that national funding is DNA testing. Obviously, there's been major advances in eliminating and matching into a national database. So they send them off to either private labs or the state lab to get tested, and each test can cost $2,000. So if you think about a single case, if there's multiple pieces of evidence that need to be sent in and multiple tests need to be done, those costs rack up really, really quickly.
And it seems like another obstacle must just be, where you set your effort. Do you tackle the things that are happening each and every day, something that's fresher and you have a better chance of solving, or this old case that if it hasn't been solved right now, the odds might be against you? Is that something you ran across in covering this?
Yes, and you do see investigators doing that, and that's the most important part is figuring out which cases are viable and have some meat left and some ground that could be covered again, or if it's just too old and it's not going to happen. So they really have to evaluate what can be done and what the best targets are.
And one of the challenges is just determining which unsolved case might be solvable. And in your wrap-up piece, again, you talk about a new thing, students getting on board. What's going on with that?
Exactly. Milwaukee's have had great success with this with University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee students along with Marquette students, and it's an internship program. It's an academic internship where they match up a few students each semester with the cold case team to do some of the hard work to figure out what needs to be done and organize files and then file charges eventually with the DA's office. And we definitely see opportunities to expand that. They see it, and there's definitely people around the state that are eager to maybe to get that rolling elsewhere.
And this isn't students going out pounding the pavement and interviewing witnesses, right? They're just kind of doing the pre-screening?
That's what we've seen Milwaukee do, but the investigators there said the students actually played a large role in the Walter Ellis case that put a serial killer behind bars for a case for years that baffled investigators.
So looking over the series, do you think that that your reporting on cold cases did what you were hoping to do?
I sure hope so. We know it had a large impact with the families and the folks that maybe thought there was just no hope and these cases have been forgotten about, and they haven't. It's good to see police keeping them in the front of mind, and we're really pushing to keep the pressure on that, you know, there is injustice in these cases, and we want to see them not forgotten.
Have you heard from a lot of readers in response to the series?
We have, and I think that's a product of almost the news cycle, where you hear about a gruesome murder or a case, and you might not hear what happens to it, and then you realize now that it's still open, and there is no justice, no one's been found, and you realize there are murderers out there here in Wisconsin, and people are interested and deeply engaged in these cases because they were affected by it the first time they heard about it.
We talked in the past about, and you just mentioned, the families involved, the families of victims. They're still waiting in a lot of ways, aren't they?
Absolutely. We heard from one family. Obviously, we heard from many families, but some just want to get any attention, and just to you know, hear that it's still being investigated and there's still effort out there and people thinking about it, that's important to them.
One thing we talked about in your coverage of the series was the database you've created. Remind us what you were doing there and let us know what the progress has been.
Yes, this is an interactive database we've posted on all the Gannett websites around the state and at postcrescent.com as well, where we went after as many cases as possible. There's no comprehensive database in the state, which is a tool that we see other states using, that kind of put a face to each case and then give an update on, you know, what happened, who this victim was, and hopefully spur some interest and help solve some of these cases.
And has there been a lot of response? Have you expanded the database a lot since you kicked it off?
Yes. We started with about a little over 350, and we've added almost a dozen or two dozen cases where family members have contacted us or police agencies have contacted us saying, you know, here's one that may not have been in your radar, and we'll take their information and we'll add it onto our database. So it's really interesting to see that either individual family members or friends or police agencies say, you know, we want in on this, so here's some more information.
You know, one thing I wondered all along with this, how much cooperation is there from one police jurisdiction and with state authorities, federal authorities? Are they effective at sharing information and looking for common themes, common evidence, or is there a wall between them?
That's a great question. It sounds like it's gotten a lot better over time. It sounds like even 10, 15 years ago, there were the classic ego and turf wars, and if someone's dedicating a lot of resources to a case, they want to be the person that cracks it and solves it. But we're seeing now that there's more departments willing to ask for help, and there's a Homicide Investigators Association that fosters some of those cross-jurisdictional cases, and also DCI, the state can get involved if you ask them. So it's really informing these individual departments to say, you know, we could use some help, we're getting close, or we just need a new set of eyes to look at this case. So we're seeing more of that as time goes on.
I know this is unpredictable, maybe almost feels random, but do you think that with your database, with the efforts we're talking about, you're going to see more of these unsolved crimes solved in the next, say, 3-5 years?
We sure hope so. I think just putting a light on it is really important, but it lights a fire under some of these. We saw immediate response here in the Fox Valley with a case where investigators took advantage of some of the momentum that we built and put out some new evidence and new information to solicit tips and to say, you know, if you're in the area, you may not have realized this individual piece is important to our case and we still need your help for an old case.
And I know the series is done. Are you done with the issue, or is this something you're going to be covering in the future?
No, we'll always be updating the database. That's the plan, is to continue rolling this. And we already have a plan for later in the year to add a large number of new cases. We have cases that stretch back to 1926, but the bulk of them are from the last 10 years because that was what our focus was. And we've done records requests and done a lot of data combing. But we're going to add to that. We have another 10-year batch that's coming, so we're not done with it for sure.
And if listeners want to help or check out the database and see if they know something that they can add, where do they find this thing?
This is on all the Gannett, Wisconsin sites, so Green Bay Press Gazette, the Post Crescent. So postcrescent.com has it, and we have a big landing page. So we have all of our stories, all of our coverage, and then this database that you can spend some time on. It's pretty robust and a lot of information, and you can search by county and find some local cases that you may remember from the past.
Nick, thanks a lot for sharing your coverage with us.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That's Nick Penzenstadler. He's reporter for Post Crescent Media.
Coming up next, it's our weekly roundup of the state's top news stories with WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Coming up, finding religion in prison. Our guest explores a surprisingly rich variety of religious experience from behind bars.
First, a visit with our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, for our weekly roundup of what's going on in Wisconsin. Noah, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, a lot going on, as always. The big news, as it seems it often is mining related. What passed the legislature this week, or what's on its way through?
Yeah. It's been an interesting news week, all told. What you're alluding to is a bill that passed out of committee today, which is obviously a step towards a full vote in the legislature. And it's a bill whose sponsor is Tom Tiffany. And what the bill does essentially is it closes off 3,500 acres around the proposed mine site in the Pinokies, of course, very controversial mine site there, and it closes out that area to the public. And so, again, as anything mine-related these days, a very controversial piece of legislation.
And what was the justification? What's the argument for closing off this wide area?
Well, let me paint you a picture of the hearing which took place before it passed committee. And I'll tell you that it began with the sponsor, Tom Tiffany, showing a video to the audience of this raid that we've talked about on the show previously. It took place earlier this summer, and it's a video of protesters which entered the mining site at a time when workers were doing some sampling. And the video showed, with a lot of swear words and other things, them essentially harassing the workers. It eventually led to armed guards being hired in order to protect the site. But I think that video was very effective in showing, at least to those folks who support the legislation, that's the need for this. That there needs to be some sort of buffer to keep protesters away from the site.
And it's a bit more complicated than just saying we're closing off this area, right? It has to do with the managed forest law, I think. Can you suss that out a little bit for us?
Right. So basically, if Gogebic Taconite, as I understand it, wanted to, they could actually close off the land now if they wanted to. But if they did that, because the land that they're using is in the state's managed forest, using the managed forest law, they get a huge tax break. And if they were to close it off to the public, you know, to recreation, then they would lose that tax break, something on the order of, I think, $500,000 or something like that. And this legislation would allow them to keep the tax break, but also kick people out.
And this passed the committee you mentioned on a party line vote,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
What did Democrats have to say about it?
Well, Poplar Democratic Senator Bob Jauk also spoke out against the bill. He was there, or I should say he was there in spirit. He was on a phone link during the hearing, and he basically came out against it, saying that it unfairly punishes the members of the public who want to use the land for recreation, whether it's hunting, fishing, or hiking, or whatever.
Now, how does the harvest camp fit into all of this? Is this on the land in question? This is the Native American educational camp that's been a rallying point for protests, though it's not being billed as a protest camp.
Right. Actually, the harvest camp is legitimately, it's actually on public land. I believe it's on county land. Mm-hmm. And the harvest camp is away from this area in which we're talking about. What we're talking about essentially is land that's under this managed or using the managed forest law. But when we're talking about the harvest camp, that's public land. And of course, that issue, as we've talked about, is also in legal limbo because it's not clear whether or not the tribes involved with the harvest camp have the proper permits to stay there.
So this past committee, is there an anticipation that this law that would allow the closing off of this land without that tax penalty, is it expected to pass the legislature, or are there big roadblocks still?
Well, like most things relating to the Capitol, I consulted my own personal oracle. you may know him as our own Sean Johnson here in the WPR newsroom. I talked to him and I asked him, what do you put the chances of this bill? And he basically said that the future is unclear, that there's opposition, on both both sides. Mm-hmm. And then it really remains to be seen whether or not this bill has a life and a future in the larger legislature.
So everything we've mentioned, the harvest camp, the armed guards, this particular legislation, it's like a fractal. Every sub item related to this mine spins off into a controversy of its own.
Yeah, absolutely. Every step along the way, this issue has been controversial. You know, you've got people on both sides, and both sides are very passionate about it. There are people who are huge proponents of this mine who say, look, this is a job creator for an area that desperately needs jobs. And then you've got people on the other side who see this mine as not only a threat to their tribal rights, but a threat to the environment. And so passions are running really high.
Well, we'll keep covering this, and I know you will in the newsroom, too. Another controversial natural resources issue, this Hunter Education Grant. There's a new development in it, but first, back us up and talk us through what happened and how this emerged as a controversy.
Right. Well, state government had this grant that was developed in order to promote Wisconsin's strong connection to hunting and that sort of thing. And at the time when they created this grant, they asked for bids, and the only bidder was a politically connected sportsman group called the United Sportsmen. They got the bid. They got the $500,000 grant.
And there was criticism right off the bat. Conservation groups saying, well, they were the only bidder, correct me if I have this wrong, because the terms of the grant were narrow and excluded a lot of the groups who might otherwise have applied.
Right. And some of the controversy has also come out of the fact that, you know, the United Sportsmen, the group, didn't have a lot of experience in actually doing what the grant called for, which, among other things, is hunter education. And interestingly enough, the journal Sentinel found out some very interesting things in some recent reporting, two of which being the group potentially misrepresented themselves. They misrepresented their tax exempt status when they were trying to go after this grant. And number two, the Journal Sentinel found that the president of the United Sportsmen was cited for hunting with an improper license a few years ago. And this is an organization that, you know, is supposed to teach hunters how to legally hunt.
Well, now, and I buried the lead here. What is the new news on this ongoing story?
The new news, and this just broke within the last 24 hours or so, is that Governor Walker has canceled the grant. Mm-hmm. And so the United Sportsmen won't be getting that $500,000 grant.
And did he say why? Did he cite some of the reasons we talked about, or was this issued without explanation?
I think, in general, this has become a political hot potato and a public relations disaster in some ways. So I think this is an attempt to sort of, I would think, to put it to bed as quickly as possible.
One more DNR-related story. DNR taking over, I gather, operation of an environmental education center.
Right. So this is another environmental story, and one that, depending on where you stand on these kinds of things, may have a political undertone or not. But the DNR just announced it was taking over operation of an environmental education center called the McKenzie Environmental Education Center, which has in recent years been run by the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And the DNR announced that they were taking over operation from the Federation.
And is this why are they taking this over? Is this a controversy there?
Well, it's a little controversial because initially the DNR they canceled the contract that they had with the Federation and put it out to bid again, the operation of this education center. Again, the Federation was the only bidder. And after taking a look at the bid and taking a look at the things that the Federation had offered, the DNR decided to decline and take over operation of the center, by itself.
Well, nothing new here, I guess. The DNR at the center of a lot of political argument, and this has been true on and off for years, hasn't it?
Yeah, and one of the dynamics here is, the Wildlife Federation has taken some pretty unpopular stands as it relates to policies under the Walker administration, and so, you know, again, depending on where you stand on these things, some look at this as, the DNR trying to save money. Others may look at it and saying, maybe this smells a little funny.
All right. Well, DNR, a political football sometimes, and Hey, the Packers football season. You see what I did there?
Nice transition, yeah. Rob. Nice.
Yeah, I've done better. Anyway, Packer game, NFL season kicked off last night. We're going to be talking about that, by the way, on Monday, 5 to 5:30. Why we like football and some of the demons kind of haunting the game right now. But I think that probably won't be on people's minds on Sunday as we watch the Packers play the 49ers.
Yeah, this is their the opening game for their regular season. I don't know if you remember, I sort of blocked it out.
I've been trying.
Selective amnesia from last season. But in the division playoffs last year, San Francisco just, you know, they killed the Packers 45-31. And so the two teams are back, and the Packers are opening up the season with the 49ers.
I'm not an expert, but I think that 49ers quarterback might run with the ball sometimes.
Gee.
I'd put money on that.
You think?
So what are people watching for in this game? A little sports reporting, Noah.
Yeah, well, a few things. You know, whether Green Bay can come away with this game with a W, it depends really on how the defense deals with the 49ers, in my opinion, how they deal with the 49ers running game, which, as you alluded to, is very, very strong, to say the least. The last 5, 6, 7 years, the 49ers have really put a lot of emphasis on their running game, and it is good. And it will be up to the Packers to try to block that game.
And on the other side, Aaron Rodgers gets knocked down a fair amount. Are we worried about that in this game?
That's always a concern. That's always a concern. You know, he was sacked many times last season, and so protecting the quarterback will be key for Green Bay. The interesting thing, too, is that we've got two new backup quarterbacks for the team, and so it's a little bit unclear as to the position of the team as far as absorbing. Okay, I'm knocking on wood here. Absorbing potentially an injury on from Aaron Rodgers.
So an unfortunate draw starting. Well, I guess that's just how it happens. They played him in the playoffs, and now they've got San Francisco again.
Yeah, the first few games of their season is tough. After they play the 49ers, they go on the home opener. They go on to play the Redskins at Lambeau. And as you might recall, the Redskins have been really on fire with their superstar quarterback, Robert Griffin III.
A related sports story, Aaron Rodgers' business partner in a restaurant, Ryan Braun. We just heard in the news a little while ago from Kristen that he is calling randomly selected season ticket holders and apologizing for his performance-enhancing substance issues. Who would have thought?
Considering he vehemently denied it last year, I find it to be somewhat surprising development.
All right, Noah, thanks for joining us, bringing us up to date on the politics of the DNR and a little bit on the Packers, too.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
That's Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He joins us each week at this time for a roundup of the latest Wisconsin political news.
Coming up, a look at the world of religion in prison. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.